Broadcasting live from Forward Observer Central Command in Austin, Texas, it's the man always out front on the issues. You're listening to Out Front with Samuel Culver.
Hello and good afternoon. Welcome to Out Front. I'm your host, Samuel Culper. And I know it's been a while since I've done an Out Front podcast. That is because I do a daily podcast for Forward Observer subscribers. It's called Early Warning. I do one Monday through Friday, and I just don't have the bandwidth to do multiple podcasts. So what I'm going to do from now on is on Mondays, I'm going to release a new episode of Out Front, which is going to be combined with the Early Warning podcast. That's going to go on the Out Front podcast feed. So if you listen to Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, wherever, you're going to get it. And then also, I'll release a video version on YouTube, and that's going to go out to everybody. And then Tuesday through Friday, I'll keep doing the regular show. There's a podcast version and then a video version as well. That's just for Early Warning subscribers. If you want to know about this stuff that's going to happen, but you want to know before it happens, then take advantage of our Cyber Monday sale. The items that my team and I cover in Early Warning are going to affect this country in the future. You can read our report in the morning, or you can watch and or listen to our briefing in the afternoon. Every day, Monday through Friday, we piece together the puzzle of disruption, conflict, and collapse. We analyze trends. We discover what the future holds so that you can be better prepared for what's ahead. Forewarned is forearmed, and that is our mission here at Forward Observer. You can lock in our lowest rate ever right now with our Cyber Monday sale. You can just go to forwardobserver.com/Black Friday. I'll put the show, or I'll put the link in the description or in the show notes so you can check it out. Now, on with the show. We start off at the Supreme Court of the United States today. They're expected to make a ruling on whether illegal immigrants counted in the 2020 census should be counted during the apportionment phase where the government distributes state funding and also decides on how many representatives each state will get. Of course, last year, the Supreme Court ruled that the Commerce Department could not include a citizenship question on the 2020 census, not because the question would have been unconstitutional. As a matter of fact, Chief Justice John Roberts said it was entirely constitutional, but they struck it down because the majority did not like the administration's reasoning for including the question. Now, the Trump administration responded by ordering the Census Bureau to conduct an accurate counting of citizens in order to exclude non-citizens from the census count. So there are effectively two different counts right now. Political opponents challenged that Trump administration order. They did not want the count to be made that excludes illegal aliens. And now we've wound up in this case. Federal funding for states in U.S. House seats are apportioned by population. So this ruling, which is going to determine whether state populations include or do not include these illegal aliens, this ruling could have a very large impact on the country's political landscape and also state fiscal conditions. Court watchers expect SCOTUS to make a quick ruling. They're hearing the case today. They're hearing oral arguments today. But the timing does raise some questions over whether the Trump administration will have time to implement this census count that excludes illegals. The Trump administration has until on the 31st of December, they have to send in their final report. The Commerce Department does. And so if SCOTUS makes a favorable ruling towards the Trump administration, well, we're going to see decreased funding for states with large illegal populations. And also states like California may actually lose representation from the U.S. House because they're going to have a lower population with a census count that excludes illegal aliens. Now, of course, any ruling like this is going to result in protests and unrest, and they potentially could be widespread if the court, if the Supreme Court does rule in favor of the Trump administration. So we expect that to play out in the next couple of weeks. Moving on, Freshman Republicans tout incoming conservative squad of their own. In a recent interview, Representative-elect Nicole Malliotakis, a Republican from New York, claimed that a conservative counter to the squad, which is founded by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat from New York, is being formed among 2020 freshman Republicans. Representative Malliotakis said, quote, "I think what you're going to see is a group of individuals who are going to serve as a counterbalance to the values of the socialist squad. We don't believe we should be destroying free market principles. We don't believe in the Green New Deal. We don't believe in packing the courts. We love this nation. We want to see it prevail," she said. This is interesting because this is happening at the same time I read this report over the weekend. According to a recent study published by the Complexity Science Hub in Vienna, Austria, so-called filter bubbles are, quote, accelerating the fragmentation of society, end quote. So the research conducted here in Vienna, or in Vienna, Austria, shows that humans seek the state of least social stress, which leads them to tune out differing voices. This is where they get this filter bubble from. We've seen numerous other studies that show that the U.S. is becoming more polarized. And so you have the squad and then this soon-to-be conservative female rival, this conservative squad of their own, which is undoubtedly going to contribute to the filter bubble problem. And I do think this is, at some level, going to accelerate our low-intensity conflict. In effect, what's happening is, you know, we've covered this before, lots of people have. The left has moved way further to the left. And there are some indications that certain segments of the right have also moved to the right, further to the right. Certainly not at the level, not the extremity and the volume that the left has moved to the left. But what this is leading to is two different countries essentially occupying the same space. And it's interesting because over the weekend, I watched an interview with, what's his name? I think it's Neil Strauss. Neil Strauss, of course, back in the 1990s, he wrote The Fourth Turning. His name is Neil Howe, Strauss and Howe. Neil Howe co-authored a book back in the 1990s called The Fourth Turning, and basically he said The Fourth Turning is a part of the generational cycle. Every fourth generation in this cycle, you get a conflict generation. He says this is it. He said in this live stream that... Well, first he said back in 1991 that there's going to be a national crisis in 2020, or he says around 2020. In this live stream, which occurred, it occurred earlier this month, he said that we're about halfway through the fourth turning. So we're about halfway through this phase, and so he says this is going to continue on into this decade. And, he talked about potential secession movements. He talked about the country potentially breaking apart. This stuff really used to be confined to the fringes of the internet and, you know, blogs talking about balkanization. I mean, I would say myself included, because back when Ford Observer was a magazine, I did a whole issue dedicated to balkanization and secession. And now to hear a demographer like Neil Howe talking about the effects of this fourth turning potentially leading to secession or, you know, breakaway or separatist movements. It's very important. And now I look at this Complexity Science Hub research talking about polarization and basically saying, you know, this is not just happening in the United States, but it's also happening in Europe. And this decade is very likely to be tumultuous because politically we're fragmented, socially we're fragmented, economically and financially we are going to have, I think, a more difficult decade than we had the last decade. And really, this is the perfect storm. I mean, this is what we at Forward Observer try to do. We try to look at political trends, social trends, and economic trends. And where those trends overlap is where you get low-intensity conflict. And so I do expect low-intensity conflict to wage. It may become, it may ebb and flow. Ultimately, I do think it's going to lead to higher intensity conflict. That's why That's why we exist. And of course, this is why our subscribers support what we do. So thank you for supporting what we do. Moving on to today's economic warning. According to an analysis published this morning at Bloomberg, a lack of foreign bond issuance has artificially propped up the U.S. Treasury bond market. With governments around the world expected to again begin issuing debt, the international demand for U.S. treasuries will decrease because Germany and Japan and a lot of other countries, they are going to start selling their own versions of national bonds or their own treasury bonds. And now you're going to have a more competitive marketplace for buying sovereign bonds, government-backed bonds. And so basically, this analysis is saying some of the demand for treasuries is going to be sapped away to international competitors. And that is going to put downward pressure on the value of the U.S. dollar. Now, of course, there's this expected return of inflation next year. We have people like Larry Summers and lots of other people warning about the devaluation of the dollar. Those have been trending topics in this early warning report. Our reporting has been driven by analysis from major investment firms, major investment banks, hedge funds, financial media outlets. Looking at the actual data this year, the Bloomberg Dollar Index has dropped 12% since March. It's now sitting at 30-month lows. And that in and of itself is not a massive deal because the value of the dollar gains strength, it weakens, it gains strength, it weakens. 30-month lows is not that bad because the dollar has fallen from historically very strong levels. However, Citibank analysts see the U.S. dollar dropping 20% next year. Goldman Sachs is actively shorting the dollar right now. And so this trend of a weakening dollar is likely to continue, especially into next year, which is going to lead to higher inflation, higher prices for U.S. consumers. I've seen in the past couple of weeks, analysts and some of these financial firms talking about the potential end of the world reserve status for the U.S. dollar. That, as we've covered, is likely to happen within the next 20 years. By the way, this is not an overnight process. This is a multi-year, maybe even a multi-decadal process. And we may very well be in this process already, where something eventually overtakes the U.S. dollar as world reserve currency. And on that point, it didn't make it into today's report. But I just saw here, Bitcoin just surpassed its all-time high, beat 2017's price. It's right at the verge of about $20,000 right now, $19,000 and some change. And that's been driven by a couple of things. So PayPal, I think it was earlier this month or maybe last month, PayPal came out and said they're going to open their 150 million users. They're going to open for them the option to buy and sell in Bitcoin. So, of course, that attracted a lot more interest. We've covered the numerous times that billionaires have said, yeah, I'm putting 1, 2, 3, 5% or however much of their assets into Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. Now, just out yesterday, Guggenheim Fund, it's a $5.3 billion macro opportunities fund from Guggenheim. They said they want to put 10% of their holdings into a Bitcoin trust. 10% of $5.3 billion is $530 million. So that's a ton of money. There's just a lot more interest. You get guys like Raoul Paul, who's very interesting to me. He's a Bitcoin bull. He says, he's previously said Bitcoin could go to $1 million. You have the Winklevoss twins who run several different cryptocurrency projects. I think they also run Gemini, which is a US-based crypto trading platform, and not just trading, but they also do custodial services for cryptocurrencies. Basically, if you want to put $1 million into cryptocurrencies, but you're afraid you're going to lose your seed or you're not going to remember the password, you basically just pay them a fee and they'll maintain custody for you. They just said that Bitcoin could go up to a $500,000, $500,000 based on the amount of interest that is being generated among institutional investors. And I tell you, I see these ads in a lot of places. There are companies out there that are targeting retirees. They're targeting people who are saving and investing for retirement or on the verge of retirement. They said, look, if you're going to put 1 or 3%, 5% in gold, put 1 or 3 or 5% in Bitcoin too. Put it in digital gold. And so I'm seeing a lot of interest in this, and I do think Bitcoin prices are headed much higher. And I bring this up not because I think Bitcoin is going to replace the U.S. dollar as a world standard trade. That's not going to happen. It's not going to be Bitcoin. But it might be a digitized currency, or it might be some form of cryptocurrency. I would imagine probably that may have some kind of IMF backing. One scenario that I could see happening is if we get a lot of volatility in the dollar, then you might have China, or you might have the IMF come out and say, hey, we need a global standard of trade that is going to be stable. And maybe it becomes backed by gold. Maybe it becomes backed by the full faith and credit of the International Monetary Fund. I don't know, but they do have these special drawing rights. People have been talking about SDRs becoming the world standard of trade, or becoming the global currency at some point in the future. So I say all that to say this. I think we are in the period of the U.S. dollar being replaced as the world reserve currency. It could be replaced by some cryptocurrency, or maybe by some digitized currency that's issued by the IMF in the next 20 years. And that is going to have untold political, social, economic, financial, monetary effects for the United States. People are not ready for the U.S. dollar to be replaced. We've been immensely blessed by having massive international demand for the dollar. I've talked about this numerous times before. During COVID, you have a bunch of the world's wealthiest people, the world's investment funds. They said, we've got to get our money as a store. We got to get our store value out of whatever currencies they're in. We got to put it in the dollar because the dollar is going to be stable. The dollar strengthened through March as people were trying to move their money into U.S. markets and into the dollar. And basically what I'm seeing now is a lot of these international investors, they're looking at the coming devaluation of the dollar, and they say, why still be in the dollar? We got to move our money somewhere else. So I do think we're going to see higher inflation. We're going to see the dollar start to devalue. Of course, that's also going to weigh on the U.S. economy. As the debt trickles up, we're going to see another $1 to $2 trillion in stimulus. Basically, next year could be a mess. I think we're going to see the economy do much better next year, just in terms of the numbers. But we're still going to have continual problems, especially if we have some kind of monetary crisis next year. So at any rate, we'll continue to monitor that and bring you our latest perspective on that. But, and not just my perspective, but also perspective of hedge funds and these massive financial investment firms that talk about this stuff as well. All right, and then let's move on to, I've got one more thing here under economic warning. So Mohammed El-Erian, I'll just say this up front. I follow him very closely. He has a history of making some very prescient remarks on financial and economic conditions. That's why I include his warnings in this early warning report. He most recently warned investors that the Federal Reserve's actions and the potential COVID-19 vaccine deployment will not be enough to prevent looming bankruptcies and a decoupling of a bull market from the rest of the economy. And basically what he's saying is you've had this massive bull market, even though economic conditions have been quite poor. So basically, they've already decoupled the stock market from economic conditions. And I'll tell you the quote in just a second, but basically he's saying, we have a stock market that's hitting all-time highs based on the expectation that a vaccine is going to come in and save the day. And Mohammed El-Erian is warning that if that does not happen, then stock market valuations are going to fall back down to reality. And there have been several warnings in the past week about a stock market correction, some big names actually coming out and shorting the markets or saying they expect some massive consolidation in the market. So here's what Mohammed El-Erian said, quote, the gap between Main Street and Wall Street is very, very large, and it is increasing, and that's not healthy for society, and it's not healthy for the markets longer term. You should worry about a reckoning longer term, especially if the economy doesn't improve quickly and validate what are very high asset risks, he said, end quote. Basically saying the market is way far ahead of where economic conditions are. If economic conditions do not improve greatly, then basically you're going to see the stock market come back down to reality, which is going to be a consolidation, contraction in the market. On that point, a couple of, who was it last week? I think it was actually JP Morgan last week. I'll have to double check that. But basically have one of these financial firms here in the United States saying, we expect economic contraction in the first quarter of next year, which means negative economic growth. So we could very well see a stock market. I wouldn't say a crash, but we very well could see consolidation in the market early next year as we go through another period of economic contraction. And on that point, a recession is two straight quarters of economic contraction. Right now, really, nobody's talking about having another recession. I mean, there are a few people, but no one's talking about, no one we follow is talking about having an economic contraction, a recession next year. They are talking about recession. You know, for more than a decade, though, I follow these people, I call them alternative economists, but you have guys like Peter Schiff and Jim Rickards and Jim Rogers and hosts of other people. They've been warning about impending financial and monetary doom. They've scared a lot of people, and they've been dead wrong for the past 10 years. I mean, since 2008, when they started warning about this stuff, Peter Schiff has been talking about massive inflation for years, and it hasn't happened. We're still going through a period of disinflation. But here's the thing. Eventually, these people are going to be right. And so when I see figures like Mohamed El-Erian begin to echo the warnings of these alternative economists, I do take note. By the way, this information is provided by a Ford Observer in this report, and it is for informational purposes only. It should not be considered financial advice. You should consult with a financial advisor to determine what may be best for your financial needs. Again, I'm not a financial advisor. Do not listen to me on any financial topics. I have to say that. Moving on to low-intensity conflict, approximately one dozen armed leftists joined an assembly of black bloc anti-fascists outside the home of Detective Jeremy Brown, a police officer who allegedly shot Kevin Peterson during a recent drug bust in Vancouver, Washington. The activist group was outfitted with batons, mace, pump-action shotguns, AR-15 pattern rifles, and body armor. Vancouver police arrested one anti-fascist for allegedly brandishing his firearm at a woman who was standing nearby. Now, the presence of armed leftists at protests and riots has become a common occurrence. We cover this stuff every week. In Atlanta last week, armed leftists allegedly set up checkpoints during a protest to block street access for rallygoers who are attending a Stop the Steal rally. And we're going to see this continue to happen, especially more overt daytime gatherings of armed leftist groups moving forward. On that note, there are a number of disruptions that are being planned for December. So we have the Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement. They're calling for a week of disruptions across the country from 3 to 10 December to avenge the death of Michael Reinhold. They're calling for support for the event, and a group called The Base said, quote, take action to help us honor a fallen comrade and to draw attention to the extrajudicial assassination by the U.S. regime, end quote. Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement, they have a few chapters across the country. They're not a very large group, but they are an anarchist group that holds regular demonstrations and tries to disrupt society pretty routinely. There's also the D.C. Youth Liberation Front. They are soliciting funds for medical supplies, protective equipment, and bail funding ahead of their planned counter-protest against right-wing groups for the March for Trump in Washington, D.C. That's coming up on the 12th of December. The D.C. Youth Liberation Front are specifically preparing for counteraction against the Proud Boys, who are going to be at the March for Trump. Again, that's 12 December. So far-left groups on social media continue to rally support. They're they're showing videos of previous violence and during these clashes with the Proud Boys and other protest groups, other, you know, pro-Trump rally and protest groups that have happened earlier this year. So we're going to continue to see this kind of low-level sporadic violence between left and left-wing and right-wing movements going into December. I do expect that to continue into next year for a number of reasons. And of course, there are going to be armed participants, both on the left and the right. And whenever that happens, there's always the risk of armed violence. And again, just to reiterate a warning, that may greatly accelerate conflict in this country. If you have any kind of mass shooting or armed violence, could spur tit for tat shootings like the one we saw earlier this year in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and then I believe it was Seattle. Moving on, let's take a look at what happened in Portland over the weekend. So according to reports, an unknown group attacked a mobile kitchen that typically supports protesters and rioters. So this is a left-wing mobile kitchen. They set up, they feed protesters. It's one of those auxiliary functions of the proto-insurgency there in Portland. At least one, there were about a dozen suspects, but one of them was armed. The dozen suspects that attacked this mobile kitchen, but it's unclear which group was responsible for the attack. So leftist groups are claiming that the recent attack was perpetrated by the Proud Boys. We can't confirm or deny that. The Proud Boys in their Telegram chats have been denying that they had anything to do with it. We haven't observed any right-wing group claim responsibility for the attack either, but this is part of this ongoing tit-for-tat violence going on in Portland between left-wing and right-wing groups. And finally, moving on to the very last item in our low-intensity conflict, alt-right chat room contributors called for the decentralization of the movement in lieu of formalized groups. Participants claimed that groups like Patriot Front, which is a fascist group, among others, with these groups that have leaders and logos and uniforms, they've become easy targets for surveillance and infiltration by both the far left and law enforcement. One participant wrote, basically, either you join a named group and become a known enemy, or you remain an unknown enemy, preparing, agitating, and fighting for the War of the Flea. And of course, the War of the Flea is this guerrilla. There's a book called The War of the Flea. It's all about guerrilla tactics, and we'll do a spin up on that book at some, like, probably in the next couple of weeks for everyone as well. Well, far left groups are commonly decentralized, and especially have these anarchist groups that have no real leaders. They have these affinity groups. They exist at local levels. And then you look at alt-right groups who have formal structures. There's a number. So there's Identity Europa, and then there was the American Identity Movement. There's a number of other formal groups that were set up and then folded, disbanded. Both Identity Europa became American Identity Movement, and then American Identity Movement ended up disbanding as well, for the express reasons that they are highly susceptible to infiltration. I mean, basically, you have this national-level organization like Identity Europa, which is a white nationalist group, what they tried to build. And then you look at these leftist groups that are smaller. They're decentralized. They're very difficult to infiltrate. These leftist groups do that because they're difficult to infiltrate. I mean, you have these people who live in the same city. They've known each other for 2, 5, 10 plus years, especially in these anarchist movements. A lot of these people have known each other for a long time. So they know who fits in and who doesn't fit in. Well, this is the interesting part, though, is if some of these white nationalists or fascist groups begin to adopt this organizational strategy that the far left has employed, then they're going to be harder to infiltrate. They're going to be harder to track and follow as well. So if they do successfully reorganize, then this can make it more difficult for law enforcement to infiltrate, make it more difficult for leftist groups to also counter. And I go back to low-intensity conflict, and you do have a lot of these alt-right groups, especially on Telegram and in other places. They continue to call for violence. And whether those are agent provocateurs or, you know, the feds in these Telegram chats, that's entirely possible. But they are advocating for violence. And So what this is probably going to lead to, if this does happen, is more sporadic lone wolf type of violence like we've seen in the past. One concern that I do have, however, is if the Harris-Biden administration does take over in January, they're going to work very quickly to implement some of their policies. That includes changes to gun laws. We've already seen the ATF a couple of times now try to rewrite their policies and regulations to go after these pistol braces on AR-15 rifles. And if that does happen, then we absolutely could see some political violence result as that, especially if the ATF starts going after owners of pistol braces. That could really be a mess, which kind of leads me to believe that the Biden administration is going to be very tactful about how they implement those restrictions, or how they place further restrictions on it. That would kind of be the best case scenario. The most dangerous course of action for the Biden administration is that they aggressively go after the implementation and enforcement of these new regulations, and we have political violence as a result. So next year really could get quite messy. As always, we'll be here every day tracking this stuff. We'll be back in your inbox tomorrow morning, back on this show tomorrow afternoon. Until then, be well and stay out front.
That doesn't have a weapon on them, you go to jail. You know what? If I kill somebody, I gotta go to jail. You gotta go to jail too.